Hello, welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, even by your standards, you seem positively skittish this fine Wednesday afternoon. Have you got an hour off work or something?
No, I haven't got an hour off work, I've got to be honest. if only. My diary is quite full, but being indie dad, I'm off to see the Giant Rooks today, who are my favourite German pop rock band from Berlin, who are absolutely ace, and the Baroness likes them too. When I say I'm off to see GBH or someone like that, she just rolls her eyes. But it's one of those rare occasions where our musical tastes meet.
It's a good job you explained the Giant Rooks for a band, Kieran, because otherwise I would have assumed it was just another of your rural problems. like you had with the squirrels and the magpies in previous years. It's Newsday, Kieran, and there's one news story that's beginning to dominate every headline at the moment. It's the Premier League and the funding deal with the EFL. Last week, the brilliant journalist Matt Slater told us that the Premier League was fractured in a way it never had before. And now, this week, Kieran, it seems like there's open civil war. They've stopped arguing with the EFL and have now turned on each other by the look of things.
Yes, this doesn't look good at all. The New Deal, and we said before, if the Premier League starts to pontificate that it's got anything in common with Roosevelt, it was on shaky ground.
Yeah.
The New Deal has not yet been agreed. There was a very pompous PR release which came out last week, but there's two issues. First of all, how much money are the Premier League clubs going to be willing to give to the EFL? And there was an initial broad agreement with some grumbles that's going to be in the region of an extra about £160 million a year. And then the issue is, okay, 160 million, how do we divvy that up? And that's where the infighting started. So according to Mike Keegan in the Mail, who has his sources, and I think there's another issue with the Premier League. You've got 20 chief executives, and they've all got friendly relationship, or some of them got friendly relationships with journalists. So there's more leaks than a Max Boyce Appreciation Society meeting. When it comes to the information. Hey kids, we're down with you once again. So it looks as if 10 clubs voted against approving the deal, and those 10 clubs: Arsenal, Chelsea, Spurs, Liverpool, West Ham, Villa, Wolves, Palace, Bournemouth, and Forest. But that's if Mike Keegan's sources are correct. So we're going on good faith there, and I know Mike, and he's always been pretty straight up and down journalist in my view. So those clubs have meant that the deal is not going to take place. Where does this leave the EFL? Well, the problem is the EFL's got a pea shooter up against a howitzer in terms of the negotiating position. The only thing it can do in order to make life a bit more uncomfortable for Premier League clubs is to say, okay, we're going to keep the two legs of the Carabao Cup semi-final, which is one leg more than the Premier League clubs would like. And that's about it. So why are these clubs voting against? Well, in my understanding, that there's two reasons. First of all, there is a belief held amongst some club executives that we could be facing an early election. And if so, the legislation with regards to the independent regulator could be shelved. That buys you 6 months of minimum of not having to give extra money to the EFL, or could be that if there's another shift to the right as far as the Conservative Party is concerned, and they win the election, and whilst I think both of those, well, one of those things is probably more remote than the other. You know, this isn't a political show, but looking at the polls, is there a chance that the regulator will not be taking place? In which case, we will go back to where we were with the Liz Truss government, and they said, oh, we're not going to do a regulator. Yeah, we're free market libertarians. And the response of the Premier League immediately put following that was to take the offers off the table and said, we're going to give you absolutely nothing. So whilst that's, I think, is a long shot, some clubs are saying, well, you know, let's suck it and see. And then there is the other issue of, even if we do agree to the £160 million, how are we going to cut that particular cake? If you cut it equally 20 ways, it's £8 million per club. That's a lot of money to, you know, Palace, Brighton, Bournemouth, you know, Luton. It's a much smaller proportion of money to the sneaky six who, yeah, and if you take a look at the fines allocated by the Premier League to the clubs that were in favour of Super League, they would seem to be getting off fairly lightly here. So that's where we are. It is civil war. There's also the potential legal claims claims by either individual clubs or collectively group of clubs that the legislation is flawed. Can they drag things through the courts to delay giving any money in the future? Some are taking that on board. And in the middle of it, and I do actually feel a degree of sympathy here, you've got Richard Masters, who's got all of the credibility of a geography supply teacher in a city comprehensive. You know, they're just completely ignoring him, and he's trying to get them pointing in the same direction. Richard Scudamore, who's the former chief executive of the Premier League, I think he saw the writing on the wall in terms of how things were starting to go, and that's why he got out a few years ago. It's a horrible, horrible job, because you've got everybody acting in the best interests of their one club, which is understandable, but is not acting in the best interests of football, which gives greater credibility to the rationale for having a regulator. I've been in touch with some of our secret government sources, not saying that they've got initials TC, not saying they've not got initials TC. The vibes there was that the government's very keen to get this legislation going through Parliament, even if there is going to be an early election. So, you know, it's seen as being appropriate given the status of the game as far as the country is concerned. And, you know, let's be honest, it's a more of a vote winner than a vote loser. So you can understand why the government and also the opposition would be in favour of it. What I would say to those clubs who have voted against, my understanding is that if we have a Labour government coming in, they could go further than the proposals. So, you know, these clubs who have voted against, yeah, the 10 clubs that we've named, are taking a gamble with the future governance of the game.
How is TC or not TC?
Very, very well,
good.
I imagine.
I'm pleased to hear.
Not that I've spoken to anybody with issues with TC. Top Cat, the undisputable Top Cat, as we know.
It was originally going to be called, it's called Boss Cat.
In America. The song was in Boss Cat.
Yeah,
it?
But they couldn't call it Boss Cat here because there was a cat food called Boss Cat. So the BBC, the BBC said they couldn't. They had to change the name because otherwise it'd be like a weekly 20-minute advert for cat. Imagine those kinder, gentler days when that's all the BBC had to worry about. It seems hard to imagine, Kieran, briefly on the politics. It seems hard to imagine. There will have to be an election before this time next year. It's hard to imagine any of the parties actually having the regulator anywhere near the top of the manifesto, if in the manifesto at all. So that does seem like a long shot for those people. The trouble with sources, Kieran, and rumours, is that we were told by a journalist not that long ago that Luton Town were one of the clubs that were most against the distribution of Premier League money to the EFL. and yet they don't appear on the list of clubs that Mike Keegan says voted against it. So that's interesting. Mm. Yeah, we were told by another journalist, a different journalist, that Steve Parish has been openly saying, why should I give my money to Stoke City when they are the richest club in the world, technically? But again, it's hard to stand that quote up. So it's the fog of war, Kieran. There's all sorts of speculation swirling around and contradictory things as well. So it's hard to get a grip on which club actually has which policy, because it seems to change on a daily basis.
It is very much shifting sands. And again, it was interesting looking at the press release which came out from the Premier League that all of the focus was on the move to what they refer to as a squad control cap, where it looks as if clubs will be limited to spending 70% of income plus player sale profits on player wages, amortization, which was good to hear about, and agent fees. So it must have been awkward in Premier League HQ formulating that particular press release to say, if we remain committed to further discussions with regards to the governance. And then there's the emphasis of, this is how much money we're giving to grassroots football. And I'm going, well, yeah, but your definition of grassroots football includes parachute payments to Leeds, Leicester and Southampton. And I don't think the rest of the world has that particular viewpoint.
You mentioned grass there, so he thought it was a walk on the offing, didn't he?
He did, yes.
And what's been the EFL response, if any, so far, Kieran, to the latest shenanigans?
There's nothing that they can do or say. You know, but they would try to have discussions, and I think sort of at senior board level, you know, Trevor Birch, Rick Parry, Richard Masters probably are in a broad agreement. You know, that they'll disagree over the detail. But if it, ultimately Richard Masters is an administrator, you know, people talk about the Premier League as if it's an independent body of the clubs, but actually the Premier League follows the bidding of the clubs. The Premier League itself has 21 shares, one of which is owned by each of the clubs who are the members of the Premier League. And then you've got the Football Association, which has sort of a golden share, but the Football Association, you know, just appears to be not wanting to get involved in football, which is really disappointing. There's no leadership coming from the FA. There's no comments, you know, even if they were to be critical, but that they just seem to have completely washed their hands. And I think that's a shame, because they are in a position to be independent. They are in a position to manifest the views of the broader football population rather than the 20 sets of multimillionaires and billionaires that we have at present.
The FA Golden Share, Kieran, is very interesting, because I think, even though we have mentioned it before, I'm sure that a lot of our listeners, especially our new listeners, may not be aware that there is a 21st vote, if you like. But the FA have always made it quite plain that it's not a casting vote, is it? So you kind of wonder where the FA fit in to this, because you would think that there are times when they, I suppose here, the FA are delighted it's not a casting vote, because if you've got the Premier League split 10-10 on this issue, the last thing the FA would want to do would be the ones to decide whether they were distributing money to the EFL or not.
That's right. I mean, you have to have a two-thirds majority when making the decisions. It does appear more and more to be an element of tokenism from the Premier League towards the Football Association. Yes, we acknowledge your importance to the game, and you're running the England team and the Lionesses and grassroots football, so therefore we're going to give you a share. But we don't expect you to ever use it. And to be fair, the Football Association has held to that position. You know, it does have a much broader remit than the Premier League in terms of the greater good of the greater game. And we're not seeing anything with regards to that.
But do we know whether the FA even attend these meetings, the Premier League meetings?
No, I think it doesn't. I think there would normally have been an agenda sent out in advance, but it tends to be a meeting of chief executives, which focuses on the operational. And unless there is anything which the FA itself thinks where it really does have to act as a backstop. So let's say, for example, the Premier League clubs voted that half the matches were going to be played in America or Saudi Arabia or Indonesia or wherever. Perhaps the Football Association might get involved under those circumstances, but it tends to be very much an absent parent of the game.
This next news story, Kieran, is one you were slightly reluctant to talk about last week because it was still, you said, very much in the realms of speculation and online gossip. But it seems less so for Leicester City this week. It seems to be becoming a story that gets more concrete as each day goes by.
Yeah, we were going to run, in fact, we did actually record an element for the show last week, and then we decided to withdraw it because it was very much a developing topic, as you rightly said. The EFL have tried to put Leicester City into a monitoring position in which the EFL would have set a business plan in respect of Leicester City. Now, what does a business plan mean? It means that before certain transactions took place, they would have to be approved by the EFL, and also the club would have been very much encouraged to do things such as sell Dewsbury Hall in the January transfer window. Now, people will rightly point out, well, hold on, that they sold Harvey Barnes last summer, they sold James Maddison, they had players like Tielemans and Castagna leave on Bosmans and so on. So they did a pretty big shift out. But this all goes back to Leicester's profits for the year to the 30th of June 2023. And by all accounts, the club is either very close to or has exceeded the PSR limit of £105 million. Now, the Premier League isn't in a position to charge Leicester City because Leicester City, going back to what we've just said, Leicester City are not a member of the Premier League. They're a member of the EFL. The EFL therefore tried to say, well, we think you've breached the limit for your 3 years in the Premier League, and therefore we're going to take over. And then Leicester said, well, but we weren't a member of the EFL when we breached the rules, and therefore you can't get involved. So it went to a commission. Our good friend, and let's face it, yep, he's a good friend of the show, Nick DeMarco, acted on behalf of Leicester, and there was a three-person commission, and they agreed with Nick's position in the sense that how can the EFL charge a club in respect of the losses it's made when it was not a member of the EFL for any of that time? I think we are in this fascinating position because Nottingham Forest are being charged for 1 year in the Premier League and 2 years in the EFL, and we have this mess. And perhaps given the focus on finance in the game at present and sort of broader governance issues, is there a case for saying we need to return to a 92 and not have two independent bodies running the game when we've got this crossover in terms of promotion and relegation? So that's where we are with Leicester, but they're not out of the woods by a long chalk, because should they return to the Premier League will say on the 1st of July, oh, nice to have you back, Leicester. By the way, fancy popping into the office. We need to have a chat about your losses. And therefore, the club could be put up before a commission and could be given a points deduction before the 24-25 season starts. And, well, we have said, ideally, points deduction should be sorted as early in the season as possible. But it's tough enough. Yeah, we only got to look at the positions of Burnley, Sheffield United and Luton. It's tough enough getting up to the Premier League. It's just as tough staying there. So starting off with a potential negative points would be depressing, especially if they also have to follow some form of business plan set by the Premier League itself.
you say, Kieran, quite rightly, that points deductions should be sorted out as quickly as possible. And that applies whatever stage of the season. And the Forest and Everton case is still dragging on. We've reached a situation where I understand that there's now less time left between now and the rest of the season than it took for Everton to appeal the previous case. There are also people wondering whether the fact that there is a full-scale civil war within the Premier League has anything to do with the delay in the case being brought against Forest and Everton.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of frustration. We have been given a heads up as to when the verdict on the Forest case is coming out. Again, yeah, it's rumour. I am standing by my bed on a particular date, which would not be appropriate to divulge. But it's very frustrating. And what we could also see is what happens if Leicester City are promoted this season and the side that finishes third in the Championship doesn't go up through the playoffs, but if a six-point deduction had gone through, they would have been promoted as being second. Are they now going to sue Leicester? We've got the potential for one of the clubs relegated in 22-23 having some form of case against Everton. We don't know whether that would be successful or not, but saying, well, yeah, the Premier League did not get its act together last season, and if a six-point deduction had gone through, we wouldn't have been relegated, and look at the impact that's had on our finances. There's too much accountancy and law taking place in what is supposed to be an escape from the drudgery of 9 to 5.
I wouldn't ask you to comment on the date of the Forest report, Kieran, but I would ask you to comment on one journalist, and one journalist alone, who's speculated on this, because of course it's speculation, that the part of the reason for the delay is that Forest, Everton and the Premier League are trying to do a bit of horse trading and come into a deal where they get a lower points deduction than they would have done, possibly, but they both agree not to appeal.
That could be. But, I mean, the commission itself is supposed to be independent of both the Premier League and the clubs, and it looks purely at the evidence. There's always mitigation routes. And again, if we go back to our friend Nick, when he came on the show, he says, yeah, all of the highlight and discussion is in respect of when cases go through CAS or through some form of charges. But he always encourages clients to negotiate a settlement before it gets that far. And it could be that the advisors to both parties have said, we'll take on the commission's advice and we're going to reduce that by 2 points per club if you accept the verdict and no appeal. Everything's in play.
I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
This next story, Kieran, seems like good news on the face of it, but I've said that so many times before, only to be met with your yes, that I'm not entirely sure whether I'm going to get your yes or your yes. But a second company has put in a bid to buy Rochdale. So what sort of yes are we getting from this, Kieran?
I think this is a positive one.
Great.
What we have is two bidders. one of which is called World Soccer Holdings. It's a Texas-based company. And, you know, why would somebody in Texas be wanting to get involved with the land of the prowler, which is Rochdale? You know, that inherently seems strange. You know, the club in the fifth tier of English football, and they say, well hold on, where were Wrexham when they were acquired by Reynolds and McElhenney? They were in the fifth tier in English football, and that's not gone too bad, has it? So, you know, the price being asked, you know, and we had Simon from Rochdale on the show, you know, they know it's going to be around about 2 million, so it's not a huge investment for a rich individual. There is the second set of bidders. This is the Football Club LLC, and they've got effectively two guys who are sort of the main head honchos there, one of which is US-based, one of which is from the Northwest. They've said that should they acquire the club, they would give 5% of the shares to the Dale Trust. By the sounds of it, the Dale Trust might have a position on the board, or certainly a fan advisory board relationship. When we had Simon from Rochdale on the show, he was talking us through the proposal to dilute the shares of Rochdale, and that was to make the club more attractive to potential bidders. Now, that vote has been passed. So Rochdale is in a position to issue lots of new shares, which will dilute the investment of existing Dale shareholders. But I've got to be honest, the shares are worth close to nothing, and now they're worth, you know, effectively 1/20th of close to nothing. So this would allow the club to say, if you buy into Rochdale, instead of acquiring, you know, 28%, 31%, you're effectively going to get around about 90% of the shares. That gives you control. And this is what the large investors are wanting to be able to do. They want to be able to come in, make decisions, you know, from, you'd think, from their point of view, to accelerate Dale in terms of investment, recruitment, and so on. And at the same time, you have got the legacy fans. You know, and I know I joke about him, but he's a good mate of mine, and he's been supporting the Dale since he was knee high. And it's part of the Prowler's life, and it's part of his mate's life as well. And those people need to be protected. And we'll be coming back to, you know, the issue of the legacy fan, the older fan, in one of our later stories.
Yeah, I'd rather just call him the fan, Kieran, the legacy fan. As we know, in certain European quarters, that implies a negative connotation. So let's celebrate the fan, Kieran, the legacy fan. And also, I'd pause here to say, if Rochdale was in America, the land of the prowler would be on their car number plates. That's where we'd very proudly welcome to Rochdale, land of the prowler. Another day, Kieran, another lawsuit for 777.
Jeepers creepers. Yeah. Where do you start? Where do you finish?
Well, we can start with the rather interesting insult used in the lawsuit about them.
Yes, they've been described as a crumbling house of cards. This is one of the many ongoing issues surrounding 777. And again, you know, the Premier League does not conduct itself perfectly at times, but you do have to have a degree of sympathy here, because they are between the devil and the deep blue sea when it comes to approval or non-approval of 777 as the custodians, you know, as the shepherds of Everton Football Club. And I don't think 777 see it in the responsibility in the same way that Evertonians do, and this is part of the problem. This relates to a company called Obra Capital, which lent 777 a lot of money. Yeah, we're talking about $60 or $70 million. And 777 didn't pay it back. And they didn't pay it back in 2021, and they didn't pay it back in 2022, and so on. And as a consequence of that, this company, Obra Capital, became increasingly cheesed off. As a result of that, they effectively sent the boys round. And what they did, they said, OK, you can't afford to repay us. We're going to take shares in one of the 777 companies. And it had this as a backstop arrangement. You know, if it's if you don't pay us cash, we're going to take something else. Yeah, a bit like the bailiffs coming in. They then started arguing 777 and Obra Capital with regards to, well, just how much are these shares worth? And it's making accusations that 777 have transferred assets out of those companies into other parts of 777 and is therefore effectively giving a worthless sets of pieces of paper to Obra. And then they did their assessment of Obra's investments in football and said that they're just hopeless at what they do, and made a series of very disparaging remarks. So this is currently taking place in a courthouse, and all good, clean fun. And the winners are the lawyers.
Yeah. Much, Kieran, as I want to see this issue resolved successfully for Everton fans, as much as any other fan does, you can't help feeling that with the Premier League looking at the unfit and proper persons test, or whatever it's called at the moment, that as soon as they see an outstanding unpaid debt of $70 million, that's going to be them saying, you're not fit to take over a football club, isn't it, surely?
On the face of it, that would be my reaction as well. The problems that we have are that Farhad Moshiri has agreed to sell the shares, and ultimately Everton Football Club Company Limited, which has been around for more than a century, is a private company. So that the EFL's role is restricted. 777 have created a poison pill by lending £180 million to Everton. What's going to happen to that if the deal doesn't go through? Now, we are aware of other bidders. I think it's fair to say those other bidders are based in the United States. And I think it's also fair to say that those other bidders are saying, well, let's take a look at what we're inheriting. If we take on Everton Football Club as a going concern, we've got debts, and let's just ignore Farhad Moshiri. Let's assume that Farhad Moshiri walks away with nothing. The club's still got debts in the region of $400 to $500 million. It owes other clubs a bit of money in terms of transfers. There's another £100 million at least to complete Bramley Moor Dock in terms of the new stadium. So it's going to cost the new owners £600 million just for that. The club's probably not worth it. And trying to value a football club, as we know, is an absolute nightmare. So therefore, could these other potential bidders be taking the view of, if Everton, especially if Everton get a couple of decent results, why not let the club go into administration, get an automatic points deduction? We're not being overly rude here. Burnley and Sheffield United look as if they're definitely down. I don't think that's being overly harsh. So if Everton get a couple of decent results, let's just bide our time, do our sums. We know what the points deduction will be for administration and wait towards the end of the season. Then let the club go into administration. They get a points deduction. They still stay in the Premier League. Can you see people are playing four-dimensional chess here? And we don't know what the position is with regards to 777 and Farhad Moshiri. Has he given exclusivity to them until a particular date? And therefore, nobody can come in unless Farhad Moshiri pays compensation to 777. There are so many unknowns. He's gone completely off the radar. As an owner of a football club, which is going through a crisis, he's completely walked away from his responsibilities. And he should be communicating to the local media, to the local fans, and so on. Even if it's information they don't want to hear, but he's gone walkabout.
Well, talking, Kieran, of owners who have walked away from their responsibilities, I almost feel this next news story should come with angelic choirs and the sound of trumpets and fanfares, because it seems that Dai Young has raised his head above the parapet and may be willing to face up to responsibility in some small way at least.
In some small way, which is probably to the benefit of Di Yonga rather than Reading Football Club.
Ah, okay.
So the position that we have is he's put out a press release in that he's open to selling the training complex, a place called Bearwood Park. And I think that's about 120 acres. So, yeah, we both know where Reading is located. It would have substantial value for non-football training use. Now, whether you can get that converted, I think, is a moot point. The facilities, from what I understand, are excellent as well, certainly by the standards of League One, but also by the standards of the Championship, and they'll put a few Premier League clubs to shame as well. So he's saying, yeah, what I'm willing to do is to sell the training ground, and that money can be used to pay the wages and HMRC. And you go, well, okay, but if you're also trying to sell the football club, if I'm looking to buy the football club, I'm looking at the list of things I'm buying, and somebody's just gone with a Sharpie and has written through the training facility. So where are we going to train? So it therefore automatically decreases the value of Reading Football Club as a separate entity. Why would you buy those training facilities? It could be that you're a property developer and you're playing a very long game, and many of them do. You know, we saw this with Ron Gordon at Southend, for example, that he was trying
Ron Martin.
Yeah. He's been trying to convert Roots Hall into residential for many a decade. So it could be that you've got some sort of long game. It could be that you think you could you can do a flip and rent it back to the club and make a profit on that, assuming that you get a new owner. So that's where we are. The Star, which is the supporters trust at Reading, they've said that they think the club is between £1 million and £1.5 million short of being able to pay the payroll due at the end of this month, and the HMRC payments, which are due. And if they fail to do those, there'll be another points deduction at Reading. You know, and it's not fair on Reading, and it's not fair on the clubs around Reading, because it just creates uncertainty. So that's the position there. Has Di Yonga's money dried up? We don't know. I mean, if you take a look at his property portfolio, it's very sizable and it's very valuable, but we don't know with regards to his other assets. Sometimes the Chinese government will put restrictions on the ability of individuals to transfer cash out of China into other markets. So there are unknowns, but you know, he appears to be, in terms of his asking price for the club, because I can assure you once again, there are people willing to buy. It all comes down to how much. I think he's putting vanity before sanity in terms of its asking price. You know, the club is third division, potentially fourth division. Yes, it's got a nice stadium. Yes, it's got a decent fan base who will fill that stadium if the football is good and they're in the right division. But if he's going to be saying, I want 60, 70 million pounds, then he's living in an unreal world. It's the work which is being done by Star, the work which is being done by Sell Before We Die in publicising what's going on is absolutely fantastic. And I just want to give a big heads up and a big shout out to the Wickham fan who says, I hate Reading, they're our rivals. I've just gone and bought a Reading shirt because it's a bit more money going to the club. And that sort of does restore, faith. And that part of the reason why we're here on this show together is you hate Brighton and I hate Palace, but in 1996 you did a benefit gig to Brighton because you saw the bigger picture. And I think fans do see the bigger picture, and that cuts in a variety of ways.
Well, I'll say this again, Kieran, if Brighton could see the bigger picture and actually pay me the money they offered me, I'd be even more happy. Talking of the asking price, Kieran, for the club, and God knows I hate myself for even suggesting this, but I think it's only right that we do put both sides of the story. Is it possible that Di Yong, in taking the training ground out of the equation, is reducing the asking price of the club and therefore widening the potential group of suitors? Is it possible that he's doing a good job? I'm sure the answer is no, but I just think it's right that we do explore even the most unlikely of scenarios.
It is in the sense that if I sell my house without the garden, I'll ask for a lower price for it.
Right, okay.
But it does mean that the person who's buying it goes, well, somebody should go and put a fence outside the back door or outside the back window and I can't see anything. So I think it's a short-term solution, a football club without all of its facilities. And again, you've been through this experience at Palace.
Mark Goldberg?
Mark Goldberg bought Palace and Ron Nodes kept Selhurst. Yeah. You know, so it does create problems for the new owner.
Yeah. I'm also working on the basis that if one of us is at least polite about Dai Yonga, he might even come and have a chat with us. It's unlikely, Kim, but you never know. Talking of fans joining together, Morecambe fans were on the march this weekend.
Yes. Yeah, and you look at the last four clubs that we've mentioned, Rochdale, Everton, Reading, Morecambe. They've become hardy perennials as far as this show is concerned, which is never a good thing. We've spoken about Morecambe on a too regular basis. The Shrimps Trust, who have done fantastic stuff, along with the board of directors. You know, and here we've got a board of directors who care about the club far more than the owners do. They've just reached that point of end of their tether. What else can they do? So they had a protest. You know, they've managed to get some local publicity and the BBC and so on. The Bond Group, who are the owners, one of whom I think is still, was connected with Worcester Warriors Rugby Club, which went into liquidation and doesn't appear to be in a hurry to do anything. They just seem to be washing their hands of the club. There's no communication. There's little interest being shown. So it's down to the fans to keep highlighting the fact that the only person that we're aware of to express any interest is a 21-year-old bloke from Solihull who's got a... they're all connected with energy drinks, these people. The energy drinks company, which doesn't appear to sell any energy drinks. So that's where we are. But again, if I know deals which are going through at present, or are making progress at present with regards to clubs in the EFL, and Morecambe is as attractive as many of those. So there are people out there. But again, you've got to stop asking silly money.
Mm. I think these energy drink companies sell a lot of their own product, Kieran, but mainly to the owner of the company, which is why at 3 o'clock in the morning they're up going, I'm going to buy a football club. Where's their football club? Kieran, we're always happy to acknowledge the existence of other podcasts, especially when they come up with, I think, probably the best. I don't think there's going to be a better stat than this year, Kieran, is there? It's an amazing stat.
Yes, there have been more Watford managers since 2019 than there have been Dalai Lamas since 1589. And hats off to the second tier podcast. They do a fantastic job as well. It's a good show if you support it, even if you support a Premier League club or a non-league club. It's good because it is prepared to go beyond the shouty noises in terms of concentration of the Premier League. I think it's also reflective of the rotating door policy at Watford. It says more good against the Dalai Lama than it does about the club. And as somebody, and again for the sake of transparency, I work for the League Managers Association. I deliver some of their courses. The cult of the manager, in terms of sacking the manager solves all of your problems, is one of the biggest fallacies in football. And if you take a look at the data backs up the fact that there are far too many chief executives or club owners who are pressing the do one button than is necessary. And all it's doing is it's just storing up problems because you're going to make these people redundant. They need a payoff. And that's money which is effectively going out of your playing budget.
We managed to get, Kieran, 4 years into this podcast without one single mention of the Dalai Lama. And now here we are, two podcasts running. You wait all that time for a Dalai Lama. There's two things. I mean, first of all, it should be pointed out that the Dalai Lama is very much a job for life. A job for several lives, in fact, technically. But I just love the fact that someone, because you know, we're used to things being compared to the size of Wales. How big is something compared to Wales? Or how big is something compared to a London bus? But somebody at the second tier podcast will, we need a comparison here. Which crazy mind came up with the idea of comparing Watford managers' longevity to Dalai Lamas? Because whoever it is, I want them on this pod. And I want to congratulate them in person.
Yes.
Derby County's, this is a great thing. I'm excited about saying this, Kieran. Derby County's latest accounts are out. After all those years with nothing, and now again, you wait 4 years for a Dalai Lama to come along, you wait 4 years for accounts from Derby County, and then they're coming left, right, and centre.
That's right. Derby County have not published any accounts since 2018. It's 2024. In my opinion, the previous regime deliberately did not publish the accounts because they knew if they were published, they'd be picked up by the EFL and then potentially be on a charge in the back of them. So it was cheaper to pay the fine for not publishing the accounts, the fine that you pay to the government. Then Mel Morris put the club into administration because the alternative was paying the tax bill, which he didn't fancy paying. And the club's been through some tough times. You know, we've had the lunatic that was Chris Kirchner, who's currently up on FBI charges for wire fraud. And so they dodged a bullet there. And all I can say is that there's been a complete transformation. The new owner, David Clowes, is a good guy. He's been successful in his own business. There's no doubt about that. What he could have done is he could have bought the club from the administrators and paid a fraction of what he finally agreed to pay. And he said, we'll take an additional points deduction for that. But because, and I know people that work within the Clowes organization, they say he's not like that. He was actually aware that local suppliers had given the Mel Morris regime not only goods and services, but they'd given them on extended credit because, hey, look, it's Derby County. Yeah, we're supporters of Derby County. And they got absolutely stiffed by Morris. So therefore, he agreed to go along with the EFL rulings that you have to pay 25%. I think many of those former suppliers have also been given new contracts, so they've got more money coming in now because they're supplying the new Derby County. The financial results weren't good. You know, the club lost £10 million. The overheads of setting up the club was significant. Player wages are quite low because the club is working along with the business plan set by the EFL, unlike Leicester, because you know it has to and Leicester doesn't have to. But you know, the club's now second in League One. It's got crowds of 30,000 for the third tier of English football. Absolutely fantastic. And I think it's indicative of how things can be turned around from what was a pretty appalling set of circumstances to something which is far more positive. Getting to the Championship is where another set of problems start. A £10 million loss in the Championship will put you in the bottom six of loss-making clubs, whereas £10 million loss in League One will put you in the top three or four.
Derby County fans, at least, though, Kieran, know that if they are promoted, and that looks likely, the stewardship of their club is much more consistent and benevolent than it has been before, and that he seems like someone who will ride out or try to find a solution to problems rather than disappear or throw toys out the pram. So it can only be good news, and I think it's right that you highlight positive news that come from those many club owners who are genuine, decent people. We finished, Kieran, with three stories from the Premier League. all of which are interesting in different ways. And the first one involves Chelsea and the mystery of the disappearing sponsorship deal.
Yeah, this is a really weird one. Yeah, let's be honest, Chelsea aren't having the best of seasons. They've got a very, very strange front of shirt deal with a company that called Infinity or Infinity Athlete or something, which doesn't appear to be doing very much itself. And they've got another deal with Oman Air, and that was worth about £2 million. And now no reference to Oman Air anywhere in respect of Chelsea. They can afford to do it in the sense that Clear Lake Capital and Toad Bowley and Co. are very wealthy in their own right. But from an FFP point of view, you know, they didn't qualify for Europe last year. There's a fair chance they won't qualify for Europe this year. They've got a, you know, a high cost base. They've spent an absolute fortune on players. You know, they've been successful at selling players, which has kept them on the right side of the line. But I don't see how, you know, unless there is more to this than meets the eye, which clearly there is, how they can just walk away from a £2 million a year deal, unless they are lining something up with another airline who have said, look, we want Clearwater. We don't want Oman Air to be associated with Chelsea in 2024 if we're going to become your official flight partner. And I tell you what, we'll give you the £2 million to go and tell them to get stuffed. And we've therefore got a break where Chelsea and an airline haven't been connected to each other for a few months.
So we're convinced, are we, that it's Chelsea that have dropped Oman Air rather than Oman Air pulling the sponsorship?
It could be that they've not paid.
Right.
Yeah, Chelsea had that problem last year where they had the Whale Fin, who were their sleeve sponsor, and that died because, by all accounts, they hadn't been paid.
Mm. Spurs, by contrast, are having a good season on the pitch, Kieran. Second half against Villa on Sunday, they look fantastic. But still, some of their season ticket holders are not happy.
Well, yeah, Spurs have... we covered this story a few weeks ago. Spurs generate more money per fan, per match, than any other club, not just in the Premier League, but in European football. And that's partly due to the vision of Daniel Levy and his team in creating a stadium which is very good at separating people from their cash. The people they'd most like to separate from their cash are tourists. And therefore, you've got this rather irritating situation of Spurs of a fair number of season ticket holders. And, you know, we're all one day older than we were yesterday. And as football fans, we are one season older than we were last season, and we're still renewing our season tickets. So first of all, they've put up the prices of some of the most expensive season tickets by around about 6% to begin with. And then secondly, if you are a senior citizen, they are making life very awkward for you. So... you will no longer be able to get a senior citizen discount if you reach the age of 67 by something like 26 or 27, and you have to go and pay regular prices. So that for those people that are in their mid to late 60s or approaching the mid to late 60s, say, well, yeah, what I want to do, I've been a Spurs fan all my life. I know I have to tighten the belt when I retire, but at least I'm going to get a reduction. You ain't. You know, you can be charged full price. Why? Because they know that there's a waiting list for season tickets. They would much rather reduce the number of season tickets sold full stop and sell them to day trippers. And that's not being rude to people who are coming to Spurs. It's a fantastic experience. And we know that Spurs have a huge fan base internationally. London's an attractive city. You just got to go there as an away fan or a home fan, and you see the number of Korean fans. You know, Son is a magnificent player, but B is a quasi god in terms of footballing terms in Korea, and that's what's driving traffic. Those fans will go in to the Spurs megastore, and they'll quite happily drop £200 or £300 on top of paying the match day ticket price, which is far higher. So that's what Spurs are doing. you know, it seems that Daniel Levy has been watching a Logan's Run, which for people not familiar, is a film where effectively it said, you know, once you get to a certain age, we're just going to bump you off. And that's what he wants. He said, thanks very much for your support for the last 30 or 40 years on your bike. Unless you're prepared to pay full whack, we're not interested in you. And given that Spurs did so much fantastic work during COVID in terms of, you know, availability as a medical centre, all the work that they did with fans, especially elderly fans, it now appears that normal service has resumed. And sort of, yeah, this ties into our earlier story. Spurs were one of the clubs that don't want to give money to the broader reaches of football. And Daniel's gone back to living in a hollowed out volcano and stroking a white cat and cackling away, the world is mine. And it's not good.
You almost took words out of my mouth there, Kieran, at the end, because there are two things I struggle to understand about this. And I generally, if anyone from Spurs is listening, I would love to ask them to come on and talk about this, because the first thing is that anyone who works in football knows that in terms of ex-players, elderly players, Tottenham are magnificent. Their welfare and benevolent system for people, anyone of any age who used to play for Tottenham Hotspur, the club is there for them. I think Martin Chivers is still the head of the Benevolent Association for Ex-Players. They're a club that reaches out to ex and elderly players. They do a fantastic job, which makes it odd that they don't do the same for fans. But secondly, the amount of money that they could potentially make out of this compared to the amount of negative PR seems to me not worth the candle. This is going to be terrible PR. When this becomes public knowledge, this is the sort of thing that fans really, really, really hate. You can use the word legacy fans as much as you want. There will always be more Tottenham fans from North London than there are from South Korea, right? And why risk alienating those fans for the sake of saving a few bob or making a few bob? It's beyond me. It just seems, as a business decision, just makes no sense at all, Kieran.
It's short-termism.
Right.
And, you know, businesses are driven by short-term issues. Again, if we move to this new squad control cap, the club will justify it. Say we need to rinse the fans for as much as we can, because for every extra £1,000 that we get from the fans, that allows us to spend an extra £700 on wages, and therefore we're doing it for you. And it will be spun in that regard. But you know, you and I both know where Spurs is in North London. It's not an affluent area. The stadium is magnificent, but it's completely alien to the surroundings in terms of, you know, a demonstration of wealth and so on. And I think that's a real shame. And I think it does show that those in the boardroom, and you know, Daniel Levy is regularly the highest paid chief executive in the Premier League. And I think he deserves it. I think he's very good at his job in terms of making Spurs a successful business. But a bit of humility and humanity is needed as well.
Also, Kieran, I have to say, as we know, 98% of Tottenham fans are black cab drivers. And frankly, I'd like to get into a taxi in London without having to sit there for 15 minutes while a driver moans about Tottenham trying to rinse their fans, to be perfectly honest. Our final story, Kieran, is about Old Trafford. There's been a lot of speculation in the last few days about whether Old Trafford is redeveloped or Manchester United build a new stadium. And what I found very interesting is that the mayor this week has said publicly that whatever outcome for Old Trafford, there will have to be public money involved.
Yes. Now, I used to live in Whalley Range in Manchester.
You lived in a Smiths album your whole life, Kieran.
I did, yes. And it's not one of the affluent parts of Manchester, and also where Old Trafford is located. And again, I play for Trafford Cricket Club. I'm very familiar with surroundings. We've seen the impact of money coming into Manchester City and the development of the Etihad campus. Is there a genuine case for redeveloping the area around Old Trafford? Yes, there is. Should all of that money come from Manchester United? No, it shouldn't, because if it's going to be for the greater good, then improved tram links, although there is a good tram link, but in true broad facilities. I don't actually have an issue with that. If we take a look at what's happening at Bramley Moor Dock and Everton, again, there is redevelopment money going in with the football stadium being sort of the jewel in the crown. But the football stadium itself is being funded privately by the club owner. And let's park the Farhad Mashiri, where's his money gone issue. Yeah, we all know where his money was coming from. We can't say that publicly. Surely the same should apply to Manchester United Football Club PLC, listed in New York, registered in the Cayman Islands, and now 27.7% owned by a company based in the Isle of Man by Offshore Gym. You know, I do not see how public money can go into that part of the private project. Is there a case for saying public money could go into the broader redevelopment of the area, of which we can use Manchester United football ground as a lightning rod? Yeah, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But it has to be done on the basis of this is the best possible use of public money for the greater Manchester area. And if it passes that test, then I think that's fair. There is very much a press release campaign by the owner to try to extract more money from the public purse. Public purse is tight. Part of the reason why the public purse is tight is when people are successful in this country, they bugger off to Monaco and don't pay any taxes here.
I clearly, Kieran, don't know the area anywhere near as well as you do. I occasionally have to go to Salford Village or Salford Quays or whatever it is for business, and I can see Old Trafford from the inevitably low to mid-range hotel that I'm put up in. That's it seems what the mayor is talking about. There's one particular underused railway station on the Old Trafford footprint that would have to be moved, and the mayor seems to be saying, well, that would have to be done by public money. You wouldn't expect Manchester United to invest in what is essentially an infrastructure. It's not a logic I fully understand, but I think the mayor's in for a difficult sell, isn't he, when, you know, given who the club is owned by, if you're then looking for public money to effectively increase in the long term the profits of those people who own it, he's much as I like the mayor of Manchester, that's going to be a difficult one to put across, I'd say.
I think it will be difficult because half of Manchester supports a club with a different colour to that of the shirt of Manchester United. There's also the fact that Andy Burnham has vociferously campaigned on behalf of Everton with regard to their points deduction. So his heart dedication in terms of football is elsewhere. I do think that there's an element of pragmatism in this as well. If on the back of it, there is a 90,000 capacity stadium, which is funded by Ineos or the banks, Manchester United will benefit. Should people be able to get there? Yes, they should. I don't actually have too much of an issue there. How is that going to be funded? 100% from the public purse? Well, let's see the detail. Let's see the numbers. I think that would be harsh. I know when Brighton moved to the Amex, they put money into, creating a bigger bridge to get across from the station. Brighton's located at a railway station. There's got to be a proper degree of analysis as to where the money's come from.
Okay, and it's a great scheme of thing, creating money for a bigger bridge. It's not the bridge over the River Kwai there, is it? I can imagine where you probably build a little tunnel for the hedgehogs and the rare frogs there as well. Thank you to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. And that includes Paul Davis, Rob Seamark, Thomas Conafrey, Archie Wilson, Thomas McGrew, Chris Batty, Steve Temple, Seth Sowerby, Solly Hole Wolf. It's like the Gladiators. Nick Newson, Liam Allenson, Scotty Walden, and David Ely. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution along with those very kind people, that would be very nice of you. You can get access to our chat community by doing so and our regular quizzes. And you can go to patreon.com/priceoffootball if you want to do that. And if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com and go to the same website if you want to buy our latest book. We should be back on Monday with our questions pod. And for all of those of you moaning that there weren't enough questions last week, don't you worry. We're making up for it the next week. Kieran had to get off to a football game last week. The backlog is not shortening in any way, shape or form. As somebody pointed out, they wrote one of the questions 15 months ago. And he got on quick. So in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, yes, thank you for everybody who sends us questions. And the breadth of those questions is absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
I normally show them to the Baroness sort of a day or two before we record the show. And she goes, how many hours am I not going to see you now for this weekend? So she's a fan of a fewer number of questions. But we do it. I do genuinely enjoy researching them. There's a variety of ways you can support the show, one of which is to give us a review using your app. And by all accounts, it doesn't matter what you say on the review. So you could even say you would rather have the show presented by Pablo Escobar and Michael Gove. I wonder if there's any links between those two people. I don't think so. I don't think. Or perhaps they were both involved in politics. Perhaps that's the only link.
Yeah, to a degree, yeah. Yeah, let's move on. Ali's very lucky, of course, because she can predict to the minute how many hours she's not going to see me for on podcast-related duties, and that is the hour that we record the pod. So the rest of my life is my own, Kieran, so I'm always very grateful to you. Now, also, I'm going to try that with Ali next time. I'm going to say, Ali, the Baroness looks at all the questions. I'll have my tape measure, and I'll let you know how far the eyebrows go up. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The price of football.
Picture this, the roar of a crowd, the tension building, the electrifying moment your team scores the winning goal. Pure joy, right? But for many football fans, barriers can shut them out of that experience. In the UK, nearly 1 in 4 people, that's 16 million, have a disability. And over 70% of those disabilities are non-visible.
Football is naturally inclusive. That seat that you sat on, you can be anyone.
For most people, I'm the first blind person they've ever met. I use that as an opportunity to inform them what I get out of the game and what I get out of life.
Living as a disabled person in this society can actually be quite disabling, quite isolating. Football clubs can have a role in integrating people into their communities.
There's so much that football does for the world. You know, educates, it entertains. Football touches every part of society.
It's about solidarity amongst people from all different groups, from all different walks of life.
Find out how you can contribute to a more inclusive matchday experience for everyone by supporting Level Playing Field, the national charity advocating for greater access and inclusion for all disabled sports fans through its Unite for Access campaign. Unite for your team, unite as a fan. Let's unite for access.